We've had a lot of information already, actually, about what's going on in this part of the world from the other speakers, so I'm going to move past some of this information that I was going to give. But I think the important thing to notice about what was happening in the 6th century B.C., 5th century B.C., was that this was part of Greece, as has been mentioned, and that the few cities along the edge, including what's now Palermo, was part of the Carthaginian Empire, and that those two groups fought with each other. But the Greek city-states were very well established by the time that Plato went to Syracuse. One of the things that's important is that the size of these city-states, I think, gives a little bit of information about how they reacted to their philosophers. They were relatively small cities. For example, Syracuse, at the time that Plato came to visit the first time, was about 30,000 people. And at that time, Athens was at its height in ancient times and had about 300,000 people. So it was about one-tenth the size of Athens. Now, Athens today has about 3.25 million. Syracuse only has 125,000, so they haven't kept pace. But actually, the things go up and down. When Greece became independent in the 19th century, there were only 5,000 people living in Athens. Just 5,000. And it's important to keep that in mind, because when we're talking about the tyrant, which we'll talk about in a little while, of Syracuse, we're talking about a man who is like the mayor of a small town. 30,000 people, but he's in charge and he runs the whole show. It's almost more like a company town. He owns all the businesses. He owns everything and gets his say at everything. And I think having a little perspective on what the situation was is what I'm going to try to give you a little bit about. So the other interesting part about this part of the world is that they had a lot of experience with philosophers, especially up in the boot of Italy, in Croton, as was mentioned by Professor Miles this morning. Pythagoras founded his Pythagorean communities 150 years earlier than the time Plato came to Syracuse. And Plato himself was a Pythagorean. He was part of this community of individuals who were thinking about ideas the way Pythagoras did. We can't get into that topic. It's a very interesting one. But he had a series of friends from his travels in the Pythagorean communities who helped him out when he got in trouble. So all along that area, all those city-states had experience of philosophers that interfered in politics. And that's something that doesn't happen too often in history. So it's important to remember that, because if philosophers were involved in interfering in politics with millions of people, that's one thing. You would never believe it, but it's only 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 people. It was still within the realm of possibility at that time. It did happen. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about Plato's visits to Syracuse, down on the tip. Plato, one bust of Plato. This is somewhat legendary. There are plenty of scholars who will tell you that this never happened. I always wonder how they know whether it actually happened or not, but they'll tell you it never happened, because the only evidence for the experience of Plato going to Syracuse, obviously Plato is identified with Athens for very good reason. That's where he spent most of his life. But Plato was known, at least in legends, to have traveled after Socrates died. But the evidence for these particular trips to Syracuse that we're going to talk about, three trips, one when he was 40 years old, one when he was 60 years old, and another when he was 66 years old. And we're going to talk mostly about the last trip. But the only evidence for these trips comes from the letters. Letters that are attributed to Plato that scholars basically say they're all forgeries. Now, the seventh letter is sometimes accepted, and the seventh letter sounds a little bit more like Plato. It's longer. He always writes at length. And it's more his style, and in addition to that, it's not so outrageous as some of the other letters. And that seventh letter actually, in great detail, goes into his three trips to Sicily, so we're just going to assume, for the purpose of the lecture, that these things happened. Let me tell you how some of the scholars figure out that some of the other letters are not accurate. Letter 11, for example, there's somebody asking either Socrates or Plato to come to one of the other colonies, Greek colonies, to give them some advice about their laws. It's a very short letter. It's one reason probably it's not Plato. But the question, the answer that Plato gives is, he says, well, Socrates can't come because he's sick right now. And I can't come because I'm so old that, you know, it's kind of hard to travel. And therefore, neither of us can make it. Well, anybody that knows the story knows that Socrates died when Plato was 28 years old. So it's highly unlikely that both of them were asked at the same time and Plato was already old. It's those kind of small details that makes people wonder whether this was a forgery or not. So we don't have to believe in the letters, that they were written by Plato, all the letters or anything like that, to accept this because, you know, just because unbelievable tales are told about a person doesn't mean that the historical existence of that person is not believable. There's almost always a kernel of truth behind the legends. In this case, it's really quite substantial because Plato was very interested in one concept. He was into a lot of theoretical things, but he was always talking about, well, you know, if only philosophers could be kings, then human society would be a lot better. Of course, he was a philosopher. But he was smart enough, being a philosopher, to know that he would never be made a king by anybody. So he had an alternative. The alternative was, well, or maybe I could make a king and turn him into a philosopher. And his trips to Syracuse were an attempt to do just that, the last two trips. He had the opportunity, and I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in a little while, but that's what inspired him to go. But what's important is that the city-states actually did take their philosophers seriously. So, this picture almost everybody knows. This is the School of Athens by Raphael and hangs in the Vatican. It's the only subject in the Vatican. There's one room, one small room, where non-religious subjects are taken care of. And the interesting thing about this picture is that it includes all of the famous Greek philosophers, which is an important thing to remember in terms of scale, too. We think of the time of Greece and the flowering of that civilization and how profound an effect it's had on all of Western civilization, and the fact that, you know, many people don't know about these Greek colonies. Now you know all about them in Sicily that influenced all that. People think of this as, boy, everybody was walking down the streets in Athens talking about truth, beauty, justice. But they weren't. Now, there's probably over a 200-year period, 100 to 200 people that made all the difference in the world. And Raphael painted the most famous ones. Socrates is in there, Plato, Aristotle, Pythagoras, so on. But it's interesting that in the center picture, that's Plato and Aristotle right in the center, Plato looks exactly like Leonardo da Vinci. There's a reason for that. Raphael liked Leonardo da Vinci. They were alive at the same time, and he thought that he was the person most like Plato. So he painted Plato look exactly like Leonardo da Vinci. And he painted himself in the picture over here. He painted a lot of the Renaissance figures as these old, you know, characters, which I thought was a very appropriate picture and a very nice compliment to all of his fellow Renaissance men. So let me tell you about the trip. The first trip was just part of his travels. He traveled to a lot of Pythagorean communities. He traveled to Egypt. This was Plato traveling after Socrates had died in the year 28. He sort of had his fill of politics in Athens, given the result to his teacher. So he traveled around, and he was in Syracuse apparently when he was around 40 years old. And the tyrant at the time, now the word tyrant is, of course, our use. There's a Greek word tyrannos, I think. I'm not sure about my pronunciation. But tyrannos meant somebody who took authority without having been given it by somebody else. And usually when people take over like that, they end up being rather tyrannical. And so the other reason for the word, or our word tyrant, has come to mean only people who misuse their power. But that's what they call the leaders of these small city-states. So the tyrant of the city-state of 30,000 people was a man named Dionysus. I've seen it as Dennis. In some internet sites. I think you can suspect that that's probably trying to capture the Irish vote or something. I'm not sure. But his name was Dionysus, and he was the elder, Dionysus the elder. And he was a very successful tyrant. He ruled for about 40 years. He kept the Carthaginians at bay, which was something that the Greeks always wanted to do. He developed the city-state. It expanded under his time. But he had a rather complicated life, and the person, he didn't like Plato too much when Plato was there when he was 40 years old. In fact, there are some legends that say he sold Plato as a slave at that time. One of the reasons people say that Plato was reluctant to go back there, because he was. But that's just a legend, and as all this is, so we don't really know what happened, but we do know that he went back, so he probably did not get made a slave. But the father, who met him at this time, ruled for a long time, and so 20 years later, his son took over. Now, when the son took over, he was a young man. Dionysus is the younger, maybe 20 years old, something like that. And his uncle, I'll explain the uncle in a second, but his uncle's named Dion. And I know they all have names that sound the same, but just pretend it's a Russian novel. So Dion was a student of Plato's. And he had been a student of Plato's in a couple of ways. He had been a student when Plato had visited Syracuse the first time, and he was a student of Plato's a little bit later because he was sent into exile by this young man who he wanted to turn into a philosopher king. Now, Dion had a complicated relationship. Now, we have a tendency to think that our 21st century lives, our family lives, are getting more complicated. There are a lot of divorces, two divorces, and then three levels of divorce, and second cousins coming from over here, and what's exactly this relationship of this child to the stepfather over here? Let me just tell you, it's not that complicated compared to the Greeks. Dion was both the brother-in-law and the son-in-law of Dionysus the tyrant, the first one. Now, the brother-in-law and the son-in-law of the same man. I'll explain. His sister was the third wife of the tyrant. The first wife died. I guess he was tyrannical to her. And the second, he decided, you know, in order to consolidate his rule over Syracuse, to marry two women, one from outside, I think probably a Carthaginian, I'm not sure, and one from inside. The woman inside the Syracusan society, and the Syracusan woman he married was the sister of Dion. Well, she had daughters, his nieces, obviously. And the second wife, the one from Carthage, had two sons. One of the sons was, the older one, was the one who eventually became Dionysus the Younger. Now, Dionysus the Younger, not going too far afield, decided he wanted to marry his half-sister by the Syracusan woman, wife. So he married his half-sister. His brother, not being very original, decided to marry the other half-sister. It's true. His younger brother then died, and that half-sister of Dionysus the Younger decided the only thing she could do under the circumstances was marry her uncle. Her uncle, who's Dion. So that's Dion's relationship to the elder one. He was the brother-in-law and the son-in-law because he married the daughter. And to the younger one, he was the uncle and the brother-in-law because he was married to the half-sister. I hope that's clear. So if your family's getting complicated, just remember, it can get worse. So Dion is the man, actually, and Plato is quoted as saying that this was the best, most enthusiastic student he'd ever had, Dion, the guy who was the uncle, the brother-in-law, and so on and so forth. And he was a good student, and he was known in Syracuse for being way too serious a man. He obviously had studied too much philosophy. He was too serious a man. But when his nephew and brother-in-law became the tyrant, he sent for Plato and said, "Look, we've got a great opportunity. We can turn this young guy into a philosopher king, you and I together." And Plato, having taken this man very seriously, Dion, he went over. It didn't work very well. As a matter of fact, within 4 months, this is the second trip when he was 60, within 4 months of having arrived, Dion had been exiled and Plato kicked out. So that didn't work very well. So now we're going 6 years later, and Dion is been in exile the whole time, and a friend of Plato's lives in Athens. By the way, before I forget, when Plato said this about Dion being his best student ever, he had not yet met Aristotle. In fact, Plato, although he was 66, did not meet Aristotle until the year after he got back from his last trip to Syracuse. Probably the reason he never left Athens again. The result of this relationship, this tangled relationship, was that Dion was in exile in Athens or near Athens, and Plato was in contact with him. And Plato sort of did a lot of financial work for him, trying to get his money out of Syracuse. So there was a complicated relationship there. And in the end, Dionysus the Younger kept insisting that Plato come back and be his advisor. And Dion was arguing to Plato that he should do this as a favor to him, his best student, because otherwise he'll never get his money out of Syracuse. Money was involved then too. So it was very complicated, and Plato finally gave in and went back another time, and that's the trip we're going to talk about. Now I want to give you a little perspective on that time, and I'll have to cut it a little bit short of the perspective, but Plato was not as famous as he is today. It's important to know that. I mean, he had already written the Republic. He'd already written the apology about Plato's death. By the way, he wasn't there at the time of Plato's death. At the time of Socrates' death. He was certainly there at the time of his own death. This is another nice famous picture of the death of Socrates. This is supposed to be Plato over here, which is, again, an unrealistic picture by Jacques-Louis David, because Plato was only 28 years old, but Plato also was not there at the time. He was sick at the time that this happened, but he did write a very good version of the speech that he gave. probably better than the original. So Plato, being 28 years old at this time, decided to take into account Socrates' ideas, write them up, and he was not, as I was saying, he's not famous. He had started his school already, the academy, which he did when he was around 40 years old, and he'd been teaching there for a while, but let me give you a modern example. In 1968, Henry Kissinger was a Harvard professor, essentially, and was just about to join the Nixon administration. Now, let's guess that David Eisenhower, the grandson of a president and married to the daughter of a president about to be president, was the one who invited Henry Kissinger to come and help the politics of the Nixon administration. That's a fairly close analogy what Dion was trying to do here. And Henry Kissinger, obviously, was known as an academic at the time. By the way, academic comes from the academy, which is the school that Plato founded. And the school that he founded lasted for 915 years before it was shut down by Justinian as counterproductive to the expansion of the Christian religion. So I think Henry Kissinger is a good example because within a couple of years after Henry Kissinger had his new jobs, no one considered him an academic anymore. So Plato, who definitely is still considered an academic, probably was lucky that he never succeeded in Syracuse in trying to make a philosopher king because he's still considered an academic. So the other thing about the history of the area is Pythagoras, as we mentioned before and Professor Miles mentioned, Pythagoras had a very large influence on the politics of the area. So people were suspicious of philosophers because they kicked out his group too from their city-states. They were too influential. And how it happened, it was very, very simple. They didn't let someone into the group because he didn't have the proper moral character, and he immediately proved them right by using his improper moral character to get everybody to burn down their community and kill all the leaders and disperse the Pythagoreans. But the Pythagoreans got very interested in theoretical ideas. So let's imagine now, and you're going to have to play a role here, let's imagine now that Plato has been tried, and you are the jury. And he's in Syracuse. This is the Greek Theater in Syracuse. This is the renovated version. As was mentioned by Professor Miles, the Romans came in and made everything bigger. It probably was a theater. This theater sits 15,000 people in Syracuse. It probably only sat about 1,000 people, so it's just about perfect, about this size at the time. And when they built it originally, they must have believed, the tyrant believed that build it and they will come. Because when he built it, Aeschylus came and so did Sappho, the poet. And actually the world premiere of the play, The Persians by Aeschylus, was performed in this theater, which you are now about to enter. Now we're going to imagine one small thing here. The problem with Plato's situation with Dionysius the Younger the second time he came was that he was put under house arrest immediately when he finally arrived. And he was asked a lot of advice, but none of it was taken. And if anything went wrong, Dionysius would hint to the public that Plato had told him to do that, and obviously it was a stupid idea and that he's taking it back now. So Plato was basically his shield of deniability, and that's how he was used. So that's one view of the theater. Here's another view. That's the last, almost last view. Now I want you to imagine that Plato has already been tried, that you were the jury, and that Plato is standing here on stage looking up at you, and you're sitting up in that audience. Okay? That's where you're standing. Yeah, that's where you're sitting. And one last thing. I won't make you wear a toga if you don't make me wear one. Ever since the movie Animal House, you just really can't be dignified wearing a toga. That's all there is to it. Gentlemen of the jury, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for doing me the favor of taking the time to find me guilty. You see, I've been looking for a way to leave Syracuse for a long time, and I haven't been successful, and I would have chosen a more comfortable means of escape. But I will accept this. I accept slavery because, well, it has not been that comfortable giving advice to our tyrant. When his use of my advice is to ignore it, and then, if any policy of his goes wrong, to use that opportunity to hint to all of you that I was responsible for that advice. So as I say, I'm very happy to be leaving in any fashion whatsoever from Syracuse. But I really don't want to take my time, the small time allotted to me, to defend my actions here, because besides this mild form of denial of complicity, I'm hoping that you find me guilty and make me a slave. And the reason is because I'm going to gain my freedom through that slavery. You may think me mad. Well, let me tell you something about my teacher, Socrates. He talked a lot about the concept of perspective, that we miss something by things being too far away from us and those that are close. Those that are close seem too important to us relative to those things that are far away. We don't have the correct perspective on them. I distilled this into an analogy, which I call the cave analogy, that we look at life as if it's shadows on a wall in a cave. We don't see the reality. You don't see the reality. I don't see the reality. We see shadows flickering on the wall of a cave. The light that comes down, it's 2 degrees removed from reality. The sunshine outside the cave in the clear light, we can see the reality, but we cannot see it in the way that we live our lives. Why? Why? We need perspective. We're not wrong in pursuing our self-interest. This is something my teacher Socrates is famous for. There are a lot of people who think that we should not pursue our self-interest, that and they think we should be unselfish. But intelligently pursuing your self-interest is the true unselfishness. There is nothing that is against your self-interest in pursuing virtue. Now, I've spent a lot of time thinking lately about the forms of politics, monarchy, democracy, oligarchy, aristocracy. And I've come to the conclusion that the main thing that we are missing is that we, in every single case, are subject to the whims of the individuals who make the decisions, rather than subject them to laws. I've been writing a book lately, working on it. It's called The Laws, trying to figure out means of setting rules for the game of politics that will make life more civilized. I don't know if it will. But I think it's very important to understand just a few things. And one is, having this perspective, I'm saying that I don't mind being a slave because my freedom is even stronger than the enslavement. My ability to think freely is more important. And as a matter of fact, it seems to me that a master of slaves is actually less free than I am. And people choose to be a master. I'll give you a good example. Masters often become incompetent at the simplest things. They have people dress them. I mean, how much inconvenience is that? You have other people trying to dress you? elbows in your ribs. Why do people do that? They do that because it makes them feel important. Important. The feeling of being important. It's so important to people to feel important. And I want you to know, gentlemen of the jury, that you will never satisfy that desire. Now, why do we try so hard? What is it that makes us doubt our own importance? Death. We die. It makes us doubt our importance. Now, I could talk about death for decades, but I've noticed that most people don't like the topic. So, let me just tell you that there is one solution to this idea of importance. And that solution is very simple. You are indispensable to yourself. That's how important you are. You are indispensable to yourself. Only you can make your own decisions. Unfortunately, that is the only form of indispensability that there is. Most people want to be indispensable in many other ways, but it cannot be. Now, we won't talk tonight about whether you live after you die or not. I have a lot to say on that topic as well. It doesn't really matter, though, as far as this issue is concerned. We are important because we're indispensable to ourselves. The only way we can be important to other people is to be valuable to them. But we're not indispensable to them. We can be valuable, and it's very simple to be valuable to other people. You just need to give more than you take away. You will be valuable. It's that simple. And how valuable you want to be? The more you give more than you take, the more valuable you will be to them. But that does not solve the hunger of being important and indispensable. But, as I said, that is why philosophy and even thinking about death is useful. Now, I'm quite aware that I'll be a laughingstock, maybe even to my friends, for having come here and failed so miserably. But I'm patient. I think that's a way too quick analysis. I have great confidence in one very simple thing, and that is that what we call civilization will not be something we are proud of until our leaders are subject to laws, to rules, to regulations, and that we are not their subjects, subject to their whims. Now, we can talk about how well, how intelligently we can craft these laws, how some could be more clever than others, but that is the basic issue that we face in human society. But you should be patient about it, because it's not possible for humanity to change quickly. We'll be afraid. And in our impatience, in our fears, is the stuff of tragedy, as Greek playwrights, our best ones, have all found to be true and shown us to be true. And in our fears and in our impatience, if we begin to fall to the illusion that one man who promises he will keep us safe, as long as we let him make all the decisions in an unregulated way, that he will keep us safe. If we fall to this illusion, don't despair. Be patient. We will overcome that. Because I am confident that the principles of life, the eternal principles of life, what I call the eternal ideas, I am confident that in our pursuit of happiness, we will slowly recognize that that is the way to happiness. And when we find that out, there will be no stopping our march towards civilization. No stopping us. And I'm confident in that. And I'm confident that we will therefore triumph over death through virtue. Of course, not death itself, but over the fear of death. What's much worse, the fear of death. And what is that? It's the fear of not being important. Thank you. Got to play your role. I can assure you that the jury would not have clapped, that they would have hissed and booed at that platonic nonsense. But I appreciate it that you've allowed my imagination to make you forget the role you were supposed to play. Thank you.
Well, from Socrates and from Plato to Spain. Bit of a leap. Our next speaker is going to be Professor Thomas Dandelay, who teaches at the University of California in Berkeley, and who has the distinction of combining two positions into one. When two famous professors in Berkeley, Richard Hur